Jeff is a professor of communication at University of Portland, and he's going to help us learn what it means to check our privilege. I got that right? Kind of like checking our oil is what he told me earlier.
Yeah.
I haven't done that by myself in such a very long time. It's only. So thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome.
I'm going to leave the doors open just for coolness
if it gets super hot, we'll open this one too.
Open that one
yeah.
Too. Thank you.
We'll attend to it. So if you get uncomfortable, just do what you need to make the room more comfortable. It's nice to make the room more comfortable. My name is Jeff Kersengrip. It's hyphenated. I used to be Jeff Kersen. I got the grip from my sweetie 26 years ago this June. She was a grip. And now I think we're the only Kersengrips on Earth. I'm pretty sure of that. I'm a 34-year professor of communication. Figured that out this year just for y'all. How long have I been doing this? I've been doing this for a long time. I found out I'm 20 years now at the University of Portland where I'm a professor and I'm a social scientist. So that's my job. Is I look at evidence, I look at data, I help students draw conclusions. We do theory-based problem solving in our major. And comm people are really interested in stuff that gets created between people. Let's create an imaginary thing between us. So we look at something like this as primary, not as like an artifact of the more interesting stuff in here or as a product of you know the things the sociologists think you bring into the room with you. We look at this thing happening as the thing that is worth studying, that affects our thinking, that affects our structuring, all this kind of stuff. So that's our focus. And whenever we're studying something from that perspective, we're looking at it as primary. We don't know if we're right, but every class you ever take, you take a chemistry class, the chemistry prof, she's trying to get you to see things chemically, right? She thinks the most interesting thing in the world is to see this situation chemically. So there's this subtle bit of persuasion in every little bit of anything you get from any of us who work in the learning business is we're all trying to convince you that our perspective is awesome. This perspective, though, is awesome. No matter what these other people say, this is a great perspective to take on this particular issue. So within communication, you can look at a whole bunch of things from even the intrapersonal. Some people talk about thinking as a communication phenomenon to the interpersonal, to group, to organizational, to cultural, to you know media, all kinds of things. I take an interpersonal focus in all my work. And my specialties are intercultural communication, communicating across barriers, across the kinds of isms we create with each other and recreate with each other, and interpersonal communication. So just looking at the sorts of things we do with each other that have both effects on all these other levels, but also are affected by all these levels. It's a really neat mix of things. And I'm aware of two things about focusing on this at the interpersonal level, which I'll tell you just to start here. One is that I'm aware of the limits of an interpersonal response to something as systemic as privilege, as institutional things we've set up to make sure that society is structured in a certain way and continues along those lines, and that we all kind of participate in making that happen. To have only an interpersonal response to that is inadequate. But on the other hand, there's a real power in the interpersonal too. When you hear, let's say, fear-mongering about the other in media messaging, and then you consult the reality of your own life, even dealing with strangers, acquaintances, people you don't know that well, you recognize that that's not actually reflective of what happens in your life. If you fall down in public, do you wait for somebody you know? What happens? You fall down in public, somebody shows up. Whoever was nearby shows up for you. And you do the same for everybody else. That's the reality that I think is the interpersonal reality. That's the power in it. So I'm trying to tap both those things. One is to acknowledge the limitations of an interpersonal response, but other is the absolute utility and power that comes from people in what MLK called quality relationships with each other. And we'll talk more about that down the road. So we're going to do several things in this little session today. We have an hour and a half. I have two metaphors that will help you understand today. Sharon's already told you one. The other is I'm seeing myself less as a teacher today and more as a DJ, if that's okay. Because I'm centered in kind of every identity category there is. I'm not marginalized anywhere. This society is set up to make my life so easy. So I'm a really odd spokesperson for this kind of stuff. But on the other hand, there's a real cool secret superpower in that to have this be one of my specialties with university kids. Because it works great to have this stance as long as I'm using it correctly. So thinking of myself as a DJ, I'm bringing a lot of other voices into this conversation today aside from mine. Mine is not the prominent voice today. I'll be asking questions, but people offering expertise both today and tomorrow's session, which is at 3:30, you're going to hear from a lot of voices that are marginalized voices and what that's like. Today we're unpacking things at more of a conceptual level, just understanding what is it? What is this thing? And how do we participate in it? Tomorrow's session is going to be built around an excellent 90-minute film that has a lot of such voices in it. It's really entertaining. You've probably seen snippets from this film and not known you have. It's one of those films that everybody has been using because there's just fabulous storytelling in it that makes a point. So that's the way this week is set up. Today and tomorrow, we're kind of unpacking the situation. And on Friday, we're going to get around to, so what do you do about it? How can you respond? And the particular kind of response I want to help you with is when you're confronted with something, there's a couple of philosophers who call it white talk. When you run across white talk, what are sensible responses to people doing that in response to recognizing privilege that's in place somewhere? So that's how this week is set up. What's going to happen today is we're going to do three things. We're going to look at, well, I guess four things. We're going to name the situation and unpack it a little bit from your perspectives. We're going to examine what's known about people who have a lot of privilege, some things we know from social science about when I'm in a position like mine, so people like me. What do we know about people like me in U.S. culture recently? Okay, what do we know about folks like me? So if you don't want to think about this in terms of people like you, you can just think about this as a seminar entirely about me. If that makes it easier for you, that's totally fine. That's great by me. Third, we're going to deconstruct white privilege. We're going to bring another scholar into the room via video for 20 minutes so you can listen to this scholar who's a really good explainer of this. And finally, I'm going to offer you three kinds of takeaways from this session, three things that start that process of, okay, if it is this thing, how do I be less the leaf and more the wind when I'm in the midst of those kinds of interactions? What are things that I could either hold in mind or in mouth or in, you know, whatever that actually change the interactions I'm involved in? So I promise you that before we're done. I have timestamps on my notes, so I'm sure that we get to things. I'm not leaving off the last things. I'm leaving off just the lame things. So let's see. Let me start here. There are lots of different responses. There are lots of responses to recognizing privilege. But what I hear a lot in the church is the notion of, I love everybody. Right? My folks taught me just not to see color, just to be colorblind. So I'd like us to have just a little 3-minute experiment here and taking that to its logical extreme. So I'll show you that.
And there are so many incredible super diverse movies last year.
Diverse movies?
Yeah, like Moonlight or Lion, Hidden Figures, and Fences. Movies that didn't like just feature white people.
So interesting. I never really thought about that.
Really? Even after the whole Oscars so white thing and all the articles written about it?
Call me crazy, but I just don't see race. I guess I'm just the least racist person in here.
Okay. Race is like often like a pretty obvious thing to observe. It's not like racist to notice.
I had to laugh. Zach, oh my goodness, I only see one race.
Such bullshit. You're only telling yourself that so you don't have to think about racism or confront your own prejudices.
No, I'm not prejudiced, okay? I don't even judge Scott for being a woman.
I'm a man, Katie. You know that.
No, honestly, I just guess. This is going to sound nuts, but I don't see gender and I don't see sex. I just see people.
You don't see how men and women look different?
No, I just see, like, shapeless blondes.
Okay, and if one of those shapeless blondes were pregnant, you would then know that it was a woman.
To me, it could just be, like, a heavyset man who has, like, a big watermelon stomach. Okay, I just am so committed to equality. I'm just a good person.
Unless you're blind, you can tell that people have inherent differences.
Oh, I didn't know if I was blind or not, because I don't see disabilities. I'm not a monster.
So, if someone were in a wheelchair, you wouldn't be able to see a wheel.
I have never seen a wheelchair.
Never seen a wheelchair.
I don't know what a wheelchair looks like.
If someone were in a wheelchair, you would not install a ramp in your building.
I would refuse.
What if someone was missing a limb?
It's perhaps tuck them in their little butt.
If someone were deaf.
Talk to them as if they could hear.
Why are you so proud of yourself?
Okay, well, here's a thought. Maybe you don't get it because you have less experience on Earth than I do.
Experience? We're all older than you.
I'm sorry, but I don't see age.
Oh, come on. You're telling me if there was an old woman and a baby, you wouldn't be able to tell which one's older? One of them is called an old woman. It's in the name, Katie.
Because I believe in equality, and I believe everyone is the same age.
That's not what equality means. I'm not too... older brothers. Can you at least acknowledge that?
Yes, and I believe both women are my same age.
Okay. What about your parents? How old were they when they had you?
I think they are both ageless and every age at the same time.
Jesus Christ, Katie. What else, Katie?
Pretty much everything. Elvis, for example.
So Bruce Willis.
Is he bald?
He's famously bald.
I have no idea.
Kitty.
There you go. If that's the response, then why not just blot out all the other things? We talk about being colorblind, but we never talk about being able-blind, right? Like, oh, I'm going to treat you as though you have legs, you know, someone who has none. Because that's, I'm just being fair to everyone in this case. So let's take a more realistic approach to this, and I'm going to invite you to do a little reflection. So we're going to do this in a couple different ways as soon as I figure out how to get this off the screen. Let's just go here. Let's go here, and let's turn down that buzz, shall we? That's what we just did. Extend the logic of colorblindness till it breaks. Have I done the right thing? I have. So for each of these, how many of you have unpacked the white knapsack before? Do you know what that is? Peggy McIntosh is a feminist scholar in the U.S. Starting in the 1980s, she developed this list of things. She'd wake up at night, and she'd start writing down ways that she thought she was different from feminist scholars who weren't white. What their experience was and how it was different. And she posed it as a bunch of questions. What you're going to look at today is a whole bunch of different questions along those lines, but querying different kinds of privilege. And I'm going to invite you to have two kinds of responses to each page of these. There are eight on each page. What I'm going to ask you to do is, if you want to, you can keep score. You can look at it and say, okay, what's my score? But I'm also interested in hearing one or two qualitative responses to any of the items that you see up there. If you look at one and you go, oh, yeah. And you see that one and you have a response one way or the other on it, that might be good to share into the room so that we can hear some of those in case everybody's experience doesn't match what's there. For example, here's the first of, and we're actually going to look at seven pages of these, and we only have about 20 minutes to do it. So I'll enlist you as allies in getting through that. But here are some. Have a look at these if you like. Keep score. I'm happy to share this PowerPoint later, by the way. So if you're worried about taking notes or anything, I'm happy to share this along with any of the resources that are in it. On Holden's website later through the amazing Sharon. Regarding the second thing I asked you to do, if you're looking up here and you see one in particular and you think, oh, I have a story about this one and you'd like to tell us something briefly, that would be great. I'm 8 out of 8 on this one. Mm-hmm. Any particular stories, anything you look at and go, oh, Go ahead.
I'm a middle school teacher, reference number 5. Mm-hmm. So the history of my country is an integrated part of basic U.S., and I'm going into number 6 as well, with my country visible and positively representative. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of minority students and black students. I don't know why black and minority seem to be two different things, but that don't see themselves in the curriculum and therefore act out a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clear when you talk to them that that's why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not interested in
right.
because they don't see themselves in the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. Or they see themselves represented in the curriculum as victims who were rescued or as problems that were solved, anything but fully human actors, which we get to be for the most part. We meaning people who look and sound like me. My story gets told pretty thoroughly. By the way, there's some talk now, people pushing back against some textbooks that have been okayed into the school public school districts in the South. There's one in Texas that is describing now African slaves as guest workers, right? Who came into this country to find work. The story is being retold, right?
Wow.
Last one.
Tends to be all one. You know, like I can find a book all about African American kids or books all about Hispanic kids or the vast majority all about Caucasian kids. So it's that real, it's hard to find stories that include everybody.
Yep.
Really hard.
Here's a second set of questions to consider. When you consider your own sexuality, is it the one that is normative in our culture around which everything is expected, or do you find yourself doing a lot of workarounds? So have a look at these. Let's hear if there are any stories here. I keep standing in front of you. Would it be better if I just stood right here?
It was our choice.
The 100 largest churches in the U.S. all exclude gay and lesbian people.
What is that number again?
Pardon?
What was your number? Four?
Number four was the 100 biggest U.S. churches. None of them welcome gay and lesbian people. Again, once more, I'm an 8 on this one. Any stories, anything that would add to the group about this one? Several states in the South right now, not just in the South, and quite a few actually, in the last 16 months or so, have started passing legislation effectively forbidding same-sex couples from adopting or fostering kids by inserting a conservative Christian voice in the process and saying, if anyone has what's called a religious objection, which has become this amorphous term, to say, I will deny this to you because we think it's bad for the kids to be, it's better to be raised by nobody than to be raised by you. So that's one place this is starting to show up again. Those laws had been on the books forever, had been overturned in the last decade or so, and now they're starting to work them back in the at the state level. So there's a lot of stuff happening around this one right now. Here's another. I have a very, this is a really nice, somebody's developing a really good analogy for how we think about sexual orientations by explaining it as furniture. Does that interest you enough? Do you want to hear
it? Yes.
All right, fine. Here we go. I'll read it to you so I can edit out the really blue language. Heterosexuality is a couch. Nobody even bats an eye if you keep it in the living room for everyone to see. It's simply expected. I mean, where the heck else would you keep it? Hidden in a bedroom? No, that would be weird. Homosexuality is a bed. Having a bed in a public room is considered weird and gross. You're expected to keep it in a private bedroom you close the door to before anyone else comes over, because even though there are a million and one things someone can do sitting on a bed that aren't sexual and plenty of ways to have sex on a couch, the first and foremost thing anyone associates beds with is sex, which is also true of people who are gay, right? Because we assume, well, they're super sexual, way more sexual than I am because they're gay. Bisexuality is a Western-style futon. Sometimes it functions like a couch, sometimes it functions like a bed, but whichever position it's in at the moment, it's still a futon. People who want to use it as a couch give you crap for not having a real couch. People who want to use it as a bed give you crap for not having a real bed. It's acceptable in your living room, but only if you make extra certain to put it in couch position and hide the sheets before company comes over. Otherwise, you'd better hide it in a guest room. Finally, asexuality is a table. No matter how many times you tell people it's not meant to be sat on, someone with no manners will try to park their nasty butt on it anyway. So, two reasons to show you this. One is because it made you laugh and think it a new way, and that's the other reason, is to think about what else does this show us about? What's another way to think about this? Metaphors and analogies are fabulous for this. One of my takeaways for you will be a couple analogies that you will find, I hope, really helpful in conversations with other people when they're doing their thing. All right, here's a third kind of privilege, religious privilege. Regarding number one, when I was in middle school, we got released every Wednesday morning to go to church so we could do confirmation classes. Public school. Minnesota. Any story for the good of the group?
Well, the only thing I think of, basically, I'm 8 out of 8, but the only thing I can think of is that, like, in Seattle, like, you know, our school, we have an awesome K-8 school, but pretty consistently, things like, they'll plan meetings on Ash Wednesday evening, you know, things like that. So, like, those kind of things. Like, Holy Week, that isn't on people's radar screen at all. Not at all.
Right.
But I realize that's super, super small in comparison to a lot of other, you know, situations. Because the big ones are all.
And in Seattle.
So, number one, that's kind of an interesting one. Don't want to work on religious holidays. Well, I'm a nurse. Half my life I worked in the hospital. Half my life I did not, because I got a graduate degree and I worked in a clinic.
Right.
Nurses, policemen, all sorts of people.
Right.
On Sundays and holidays, and it's just something that's assumed, and then they do all the time. And nobody thinks about that.
You know what the easy solution to that is? Is to have a super diverse workforce. Right? like divided up about like the culture is. So when I'm off for a Christian holiday, you know, my Islamic mate is able to work just fine. Or my Jewish colleague or my atheist colleague who should be on call all the time is really ready. Let's look at another one. How about this one, gender or sex? This one's always difficult to talk about. Gender is actually how I know myself, and gender expression is how I express that gender. Sexuality, of course, is my sexual orientation. So this one's just thinking about, are you a man or a woman, or do you come across as male, female to people?
I could speak to that.
Please do.
Many, many years ago, I was a geology major in college. The number of women doing that in those days was infinitesimal. Mm-hmm. There was a fair amount of, no, women don't do that.
Right.
But today, every time I read about a geologist or see one on television, it's a woman. Mm-hmm. It still amazes me.
Mm-hmm. In a bad way?
No.
Yeah, good. I was kidding. I knew where you were going there. Yeah. That is pretty cool. Although I'm still susceptible. I hear somebody say professor, and the image that appears in my head is a man. And I study this stuff, and I do this advocacy for a living. Someone says doctor, I see a man. Right? I am so susceptible to gender stereotypes, I have to put in that extra move and say, dope. You know. Last week we called that TUI, thinking under the influence. Like I could pull myself over for TUI when I did that. I do it a lot, and it's normal that we do this. Let's look at a couple more. How about race?
Mm-hmm. I have an African-American friend who...
Go, Cynthia.
...was shopping and watching white women shoplift. That she was being
called. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Emily went grocery shopping with our 24-year-old, one of our daughters, came to live with us, an adult, and she's 24. And we have hardly ever grocery shop with her, but Em came home saying she'd never gotten so many offers of help in the grocery store. And Mia looked at her and said, oh yeah. You know, because it's like, do you need something? Can I help you find something? They were together. But it was, you know, they were especially attentive to an African-American customer. And they were polite, but Em said, when I go there on my own, what'd you say?
Oh, nobody ever asked me if I'm looking for something.
Right, right.
But every time mm-hmm. you right. someone walked over and said, yeah.
Right. So we think of people of color, especially African-American people of color in this country, more as spectacle than as people, more as something in our horizon to pay attention to than as the whole person they are. That's the TUI part that, you know, we call ourselves back from periodically. Any others on this one? Right.
You know, had we been black women or something else.
Sure.
But we decided not to use those. Mm-hmm. Other
and yet you were pretty confident.
Just, yeah, but it was mm-hmm. just, you know, one of those, you know, we're also, you know, going to break the rules. But, mm-hmm. but anyway, it was, I said, well, we can get away with it. We're white.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think you'll like one of the other analogies coming later, too. I think this is the last one. Let's look at ability. Here's one that's kind of hidden. Right. Do you have to think about whether you'll have access to a building? Mm-hmm. Some folks call that inspiration porn. Inspiration porn, like somebody who's got no legs and no arms, yet you know works full time and is a whole person in her life, and just hates to have that like overcoming adversity story told about her. Just says, knock that crap off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's when they become interesting. Any stories? Any of you affected personally or?
That well, my dad is in a wheelchair now, and it wasn't until my dad, who I was with on an almost daily basis, mm-hmm. was in a wheelchair that I became super aware for the first time. I'm ashamed to say, I mean, I was aware, but mm-hmm. not on that level of what buildings we couldn't go into, mm-hmm. and it made me quite upset when mm-hmm. there was ever something
yeah.
to have access to.
I had a student who was blind a few years back. Ryland from Hawaii, just a super nice guy. And I'm a good teacher, and I would think a lot about what I'm teaching and how I'm teaching it. And I'd come into class and I'd say something like, okay, I'm going to put something up on the screen, and I'd go, oh, Ryland, I did it again. You know, I just put something up, and he'd go, oh, it's fine, I'll work with somebody, you know, and Ryland, work with me, you know, people, like, they'd get together. But I was the continual workaround in that class with this, happened to be a super nice kid around that. But even when you're doing it on purpose, our norm is to set up, just to assume that I can do these things I like to do that are comfortable for me, that work for me, and that often that doesn't work for other people. Again, if you want this, this PowerPoint can be yours. I sound like I'm doing the game show. Here, a new PowerPoint. You know, you can have this for just attending the session if you like. So what? So we're high scorers, many of us. If we are not high scorers, that's still a so what. It's like, yeah, I'm kind of at the bottom of a few of these. I didn't come away with as many points as I should. So what do we know about this? Well, our reality in the country right now is pretty interesting. Most white U.S. Americans, that's to distinguish us from other kinds of Americans, like South Americans and Central Americans, who hate us calling ourselves Americans, because they are too, generally believe racism's over with. Only 16% of white Americans say there's a lot of racial discrimination still. If you ask people of color, the percentage, of course, is hugely higher. Many, in fact, even believe U.S. white people are, in fact, the ones being discriminated against now, that there is a war against white people going on. And of course, when your privileges feel like they're eroding, that feels like discrimination, if I haven't felt anything else. I don't mean to laugh at people like me, right? In this circumstance, I can see the combination of media messaging, political expediency, and my own insecurities that could lead me to this point, right, if I'm in that situation, to say that's a plausible explanation. I like that one. I'm stopping there, right? That the other things involve a little more self-reflection, a little more investment, so it makes sense that we get there. People of color are not immune, right? We also participate in those systems that are out there, despite the fact that doing so continues those marginalizations. We aren't the only ones. For example, internalizing white beauty standards. If you look at the covers of magazines, is everybody trying to look more and more African? Are the white people trying to change themselves so they can look more and more African so they get on the magazine covers? No, it's the other way around. In fact, it's not just in this country. So we know lots of these things that exist, right? And the temptation is to say, wow, what's wrong with those people? Like, these things keep happening to black and brown people in the world. They must just be deficient, right? Thinking about those kinds of things. But when you look at how systemic it is, and there's plenty of research out there about how we are not perfect sense makers. There's a lot of implicit biasing in our own sense making for ourselves and other people, that the more plausible explanation has to do with something more systemic than just a whole, because my skin color is a certain color, I'm a bad person or a stupid person. So again, my focus is on how do you get conversations started? How do you stay connected to people who seem other than you? How do you feel like walking toward those people instead of walking away from them? What gets you in that space, and then what helps that space be productive, fruitful, in the words that are on screen here? What has to be in place for that to happen? And in fact, we're not really well equipped to have those. I want to show you buzz through some research in a second so you can see this. But the sense is that all this stuff is in the water that we are all floating in. I may think I'm just sitting in a pond, but in fact, if you know, you look at the shore, you're drifting right along. The pond is a river. You know, it's kind of leading you a certain way. And if you don't want to go that way, you kind of have to work to stay out of that mainstream. Do you like my work thing? Does this work for you? That it's in the water. It's really there for a lot of us. And we can do some things once we see it. We can't subvert it at the interpersonal level. We can start to do some things that are helpful. Here are some of the things we know from social science that are, for us, high scorers, people like me. Here are some findings. Just look at the yellow part for now. If you'd like to know more, of course, I've got some more in here that I'll share with you. It's right here. People like me, college professors across race, ethnicity, and gender, meaning professors of all colors, are more likely to respond to queries from students they believe are white males. This was about requests for mentorship. It was a very cleverly designed study. There's one. I'll show you 10 of these. White people, including white children, are less moved by the pain of people of color, including children of color, than by the pain of fellow whites. Look at that first study. Around age 7, white children begin to believe black children are less susceptible to pain than white children are. Wow. U.S. emergency room personnel are sometimes slower. A third study found white people feel less empathy toward black people in pain than they do for whites experiencing pain. By the way, doctors in the U.S. routinely make the same mistake with women of all races, that they take women's pain less seriously than men's. We doubt women and the truth of their own emotional experiences. Here's the third one. I'm more likely to have done illegal drugs than people who are Black or Latino in this culture, but I'm far less likely to go to jail for that. You probably heard that one before. Black men are sentenced to far lengthier prison sentences than white men for the same crimes. 2012, nearly a 20% longer. And if you look at this, this is all during the Obama era, right, when we had an African-American president. By the way, he's also our most recent Irish-American president. If you ever get asked that question, who's our most recent Irish-American president? It's Barack Obama. He is as Irish as he is Kenyan in his descent. But in a white supremacist culture, we note deviations from whiteness as the thing to remark on. So he's African-American. If he'd presented himself as an Irish-American president, can you imagine the hell, right, that he would have had to take? But look at this. Sentences were 15.2% longer, but from 2007 to 2011, more recent study, that actually increased, right, to 20% longer. So this isn't something that's getting better. This is something that's actually, the disparity is increasing. White people, including police, see Black children as older and less innocent than white children. That has some implications, don't you think? Black children are more likely to be tried as adults and are given harsher sentences than white children. Here are the studies here, if you'd like to see. White people are more likely to support the criminal justice system, including the death penalty, when they think it's disproportionately punitive toward Black people. This one we need to unpack. 2012, Stanford study. And this was done in San Francisco and New York, chosen on purpose because they're relatively progressive places. When I was told that U.S. Black people were unfairly impacted by punitive criminal justice policies, I was less likely to advocate for criminal justice reform. Telling Wrights about racist sentencing laws made them favor harsher sentences. And the authors highlighted it as their most startling finding. I become more supportive of really draconian penalties upon learning it discriminates against Black people. The more stereotypically Black a defendant looks in a murder case, the higher the likelihood he'll be sentenced to death. This is based on research on actual cases, not made-up cases. U.S. white people falsely recall Black men they perceive as being smart as being lighter skinned than they actually were. So when you're asked to, this was a very clever study. They were shown pictures of African-American men they were told were educated, and then later on they were asked to recall those men's faces with a color hue chart, and they kept choosing lighter for the more educated ones. So it's a really subtle bias we've got toward this. So that's how I resolve the cognitive dissonance I feel, right, between there's a Black man who's educated. I'm not supposed to think of those two things in the same verse, right? So I make the person a little less Black in my recollection. In this case, just in sense of color. Here's a couple more. White people view lighter-skinned African-Americans and Latinos as more intelligent, competent, trustworthy, and reliable than their darker-skinned peers. So even within races, we tend to favor people who are paler rather than people who are darker, just in skin tone. There's more! Even preschoolers are far more likely to be suspended from school if they're students of color than white students are. The same products displayed by Black hands on the internet, if that's all you see is the product in hands, they don't sell as well as if the hands are white. Have you ever seen a billboard for a U.S. firing range or firearms that had a Black protagonist in it? Ever? Or someone in a hijab? Right, saying you need to take care of this?
Contributing to the preschool study, there was a study they did on teachers and just looking at how they kind of perceived younger students, preschoolers versus kindergartners. They found that in just looking at maybe why they were punished more so, is they noticed that the teachers were looking at the Black students more than the white students to begin with. So you're not going to find things wrong in the white students because you're not looking at them.
Right.
Whereas the teachers were sort of looking for something wrong in the Black students.
Yeah. Since you've had education, you know some of those studies about all kinds of things, not just about race, but when the teacher expectations are messed with, like they're told falsely that here are the smart kids in your class, then they wind up with the best grades. You know, it's crazy how much we are driven by our expectations.
Yeah.
Called out meaning what?
Well, just sort of, called out being said, you know, this
images, say something different.
Great. This last one strikes me, too. When you think of working class American, Samantha Bee, I think, did a comedy routine on this where she went off to an imaginary bar to interview a working class person, and all the guys in hard hats and Carhartts were taken. And she got ushered into this back room where there were actual working class Americans, and they were mostly female, mostly people of color doing that kind of work. And yet, why does this one image dominate so much? You know, Joe Sixpack or whatever it's called would be that. That's the image we see. Wait, there's more. By the way, when we're talking whiteness, usually it gets studied as this constellation of things that are supposedly allied with a standard U.S. white American experience. So they're usually a combination of skin tone like mine, wealth, masculinity, and heterosexuality. All those things are kind of assumed to constitute something that's often referred to as whiteness. To which we're aspiring, and that many people automatically conflate, meaning confuse the two, what it means to be American with what it means to be white. And we judge each other according to those standards. And people overseas will judge you. If you're, let's say, a Kenyan-American traveling overseas, you tell them you're American, and they say, no, you know, that's not what Americans look like. It's just this unconscious conflating of the two pieces that really matters here. Current White House interns? 81 men, 34 women. I mean, the population split about 50-50. There are a few more women than men. Would you be okay with the flipped ratio? Would you be okay with 81 black women? Yeah, I would. I mean, it'd be interesting. Just do that for 200-some years and see how that happens, see what happens. But most people, when you think about it, it's like, well, that's just the way it is. You know, that's how it is. So that's white supremacy there. Women comprise about 20% of Congress. The current policymaking cabinet is more white and more male than any since the early 1980s. So let's listen to somebody besides me. I like that idea. And then we'll come back and I'll offer you some takeaways here. Dr. Robin Angelo, D'Angelo, does a really good job explaining these things, and I have to go all the way back out to my stick to get her, so sorry, it'll take a minute here. Where are you? Oh, here. How about that? I won't make you look. Here it is. She'll talk for about 20 minutes here, and she's good. By the way, I'm taking my motto this week from Gary Mason, Reverend Mason, who said, I'm going to raise a lot more questions than give answers this week. So we're to that portion now of this talk, if you're even calling it a talk, and that I've shared a couple things with you that are meant to build on this idea. This is meant to spur things that you want to talk about over coffee or beer, if you brought beer, with each other, and you're thinking about what's, you know, well, what did you think of that? That's a great conversation starter. I wanted you to be able to see some other artifacts, and I passed two of those around for you here. I've got three different kinds of takeaways for you today. Let's see if I can get back where I need to be. Indeed, I can, and I can turn this down again. Sounds like there's a small plane flying around the room every time I leave this up.
Do you have the first one that you passed around? We didn't get it back.
I do. There we go. So that's this one. This is just a scholar who studies our interactions with whiteness, and he's identifying several different ways we can do that. And it's worth looking at for yourself, Barnard Hess's work. Let's see, I think I have it here, yeah. The one I'd point out to you today is the third one. Actually, just looking at white privilege is one expression, but not the only expression of white supremacy. That white privilege isn't happening just in my head, that it's actually an expression of this structural stuff, and to some degree, it's a choice I've made, whether I'm having that particular interaction with supremacy. So we can go all the way from white supremacy maintains and advocates a clearly marked white society that preserves, names, and values white superiority. There are people who move through the world with that kind of entanglement with whiteness, all the way down to some more at the bottom, white abolitionists, changes institutions that are historically based on white rule. For example, the real estate industry dismantles the regime of whiteness, doesn't allow the regime to reassert itself. So there are people at both ends of the spectrum and everywhere in between. Sir?
Is this worldwide?
No, he's studying in the U.S. If you go to another culture, like you go to China, whiteness is, it's still valued a little because it's pretty universal, especially like beauty standards and stuff still look pretty anglicized, and fair skin is kind of valued all around the world. But in that culture, we would be among the marginalized folks compared to, say, Mandarin.
France and England and stuff, they're very diverse. And they have the issue of
Large part they do, although not to the degree that we do. There's even stories of when our black soldiers went overseas in World War I, they went to France. And for the very first time, they were treated as people rather than as black people. And it was shocking to them to be able to, you know, come into a restaurant, sit down with us. Who are you? You soldiers. You know, that's why you're here. You're American soldiers. That's how they saw them. And for many of them, that was their first shot at that, of being seen as a person. You don't notice the water you're in until you're in a different pool and start to see it. So this is one of three takeaways of this sort, which is just to say, huh, what's a way to think about my entanglements with that particular piece? Here's a second one of this sort. I read a provocative post by a guy who said, do you go to a white supremacist church? Do you go to a white supremacist church? And he set a pretty low bar. Three questions he asked was, if you were seeing the KKK gather in Charlottesville last year, and what your church decided to talk about was free speech rather than the clear immorality of those actions, then you go to a church that's invested in white supremacy, as Jesus never was, you know, when you think about it. If you go to a church with people who are able to watch the flag carrying and chanting Nazi slogans and still try to tell you the flag is about heritage, not hate, this is a provocative post, right, thinking about these things. Or this whole laundry list of stuff here on the bottom. Both sides are wrong, anti-fascists are throwing things too, reverse racism in a way that is not ironic. If they blame BLM for any of the violence that broke out, if they try to white-splain the non-violence of Martin Luther King to people of color who are themselves being actively oppressed, you're surrounding yourself with people who are invested in white supremacy to a degree that Jesus never was, right? So thinking about our institutions, it's really tempting, because I'm hearing it in church, to say, oh, this must be good stuff. I just found these interesting questions to ask of my own church experience. And what did we talk about around the Charlottesville stuff? Not just in the sanctuary, but around coffee. What sorts of things got discussed? And which of those things had what relationship with white supremacy? So I wanted you to have these three bits. Is the Hesse thing I gave you first. Those questions are kind of interesting to ask. And finally, the second handout I passed around to you is something that's created here in the state of Washington. I would change one thing about the handout. It's a way of thinking interpersonally about power and how you engage in systems of power, of which whiteness is one. I would change just one word. I'd add one word to every one of the questions there, and that word is when. I would put when on the front of each of those questions. So instead of saying, do I challenge or question the tone, attitude, or manner of others, I would say, when do I challenge the tone, manner, or attitude of others? To turn it into a question of value rather than saying, I am always this or always that, just think about, well, when do I do that? And why do I do it then? Oh, can I recreate those conditions so I could do it more often? This is one of those things that's a great little thing to put up on the fridge, you know, and just think about it. Like, take one on as a discipline for a week and say, I think I want to try this for a while. That's the impetus behind the folks who created this. So one kind of takeaway for you are these. Means just to reflect on your own ongoing relationships and entanglements with this system. Where do you hang on to it? Where do you resist it? Where does it seem to be buffeting you about and you didn't really notice that? These are three doorways into that. A second thing I wanted to offer you were these two analogies that help people understand white supremacy. They help you understand the system as not being personal, but rather being systemic. One is a terrific little blog post, again, from a guy who said, a white guy, who said, I discovered this when I was biking, that living in a world that is segregated by race is a lot like biking in a world made for automobiles and cars. I'm allowed to be there, right? But the roads weren't designed for me, especially. And I can get there. Sometimes I can get all the way where I need to go on roads. Sometimes I have to get on a sidewalk, and people give me a hard time for being on the sidewalk. What are you doing on the sidewalk? You're a bike. Get in the street. You get in the street. Get out of my way. What are you doing here? You know, you're just a person. So aside from the people who are actively trying to knock you off your bike, they're just really nice people going by in their cars throwing gravel at you, right? Their car's just like, ow. You know, I'm as likely to get hit by a person of color driving a truck going past me on the road while I'm on my bike as I am to be hit by anybody else. It's the system. So if you like this, this is another one of the sites I'll share with you, but it's a fabulous little analogy for people to say, hey, it's just like biking in a world made for cars. Think about that. Would you choose that? Right? Or would you choose to drive on roads that were made for bicyclists? Would you swap your position? Would you think, yeah, I'd do that. That's fine. It's like, no, I kind of like driving on roads made for cars. I'm in a car. You know, I get where I need to go. The second one is, this was for and from gamers. This video gamer said, imagine that you go into the default setting of a new game you're going to play called The Real World. And the straight white male setting is automatically assigned to you. You have no choice over that. Okay, that's just what you have. So it's mostly about, the game is mostly about acquiring money, acquiring status. You fiddle with the defaults. Straight white male is the lowest difficulty setting there is. Okay, so you play the game. You might try to choose something else, but sorry, John, you're always going to get that setting for people. The default behaviors for almost all the non-player characters in the game are easier on you than they would be otherwise. For completion of quests, for leveling up thresholds, give him a break. He's just a kid, right? A white kid. Automatic entry to some parts of the map that others have to work for. In other words, you go through a door you didn't even know was a door. It looked like a hallway to you. Somebody behind you, you know, the door might be shut on that sort of thing. The game's easier to play automatically, and when you need help, by default, it's easier to get. You were talking about finding a restroom. We need help. We got to go pee. I bet we could go to that golf course if we wanted to, and you'd be right. I bet they wouldn't have any trouble with that. Here's the piece that people sometimes miss about this analogy is you can still lose. You can lose the game playing on the easiest setting, but it is the easiest setting. It's still possible to be a white person in the U.S. and not have things go great for you. It doesn't guarantee anything. It just makes the game easier. So this is a second kind of takeaway. It's just a couple analogies that help get people to the systemic understanding of what does it mean to live in a society that values whiteness in all its manifestations. Well, like biking in a world made for cars. Well, like playing a video game where the setting keeps getting chosen for you that is the easiest of the settings. Really nice. And finally, one gift, because I think it'll make you smile, and we do indeed have time for it, I hope we do. Here are a couple of nice ways to deal with questions that people like to ask that are sort of distraction questions. Like, a lot of people like to say, well, what about the N-word? How come we can't say the N-word? You know, I won't acknowledge the reality of a racist system until somebody can answer this question for me, right? Why can't I say it? So here's a really nice response. Again, have you seen it? Yeah. He does a really good job describing it, so I want to go there. He's at the end of a talk he gave, a student asked it in an auditorium. It's a friendly question and a friendly answer, but I'd like you to see it, because he explains it very well in a way that you will smile at and understand it. Let's see if I can get this to show up here.
Weston had this concert with Lil Uzi Vert. He uses the N-word profusely, like a ton, and there was an email sent out to students who went to this concert saying, you don't have the right to use this word, which I 100% agree with. As a white person, I don't have any right. I haven't, until reparations are made, until there's some sort of giving back, there's no right. But what do you say to, I don't know what to do when I hear my friends using this word in a song. I don't know what to do when it's used it all the time.
Words don't have meaning without context, okay? My wife refers to me as honey. That's accepted and okay between us. If we were walking down the street together and a strange woman referred to me as honey, that wouldn't be acceptable. The understanding is I have some sort of relationship with my wife. Hopefully I have no relationship with this strange woman. When I was young, I used to go see my family in Philadelphia where my dad was from. They would all call him Billy. His name is William Paul Coates. No one in Baltimore called him Billy, and had I referred to my father as Billy, that probably would have been a problem. That's because the relationship between myself and my dad is not the same as the relationship between my dad and his mother and his sisters who we grew up with, right? We understand that. It's the same thing with words within the African-American community, or within any community. My wife, with her girlfriend, will use the word bitch. I did not join in. I don't do that. And perhaps more importantly, I don't have a desire to do it. You understand? You know, a while ago, Dan Savage was gonna have this show that he was going to call Hey Faggot. I'm not gonna yell faggot at Dan Savage. That's not my relationship with the LGBT community. And I understand that, and I'm okay with that. I don't have a desire to, yell out the words, faggot. I just don't have that. The question one must ask, if that's accepted and normal for groups of people, we understand that, it's normal, actually, for groups to use words that are derogatory in an ironic fashion. Why is there so much hand-wringing when black people do it? Black people are basically, you know, however you feel about it, they're not outside of the normal rules and laws for humanity. I had a, you know, a good friend who used to have this cabin in upstate New York, which he referred to as the white trash cabin. He was white. I would never refer to that cabin. I would never tell him I'm coming to your white trash cabin. I just wouldn't do that. I think you understand why I wouldn't do it. The question one must ask is why so many white people have difficulty extending things that are basic laws, you know, of how human beings interact to black people. And I think I know why. When you're white in this country, you're taught that everything belongs to you. You think you have a right to everything. You have a right to go with you. I mean, you're conditioned this way. It's not, you know, because you know your hair is a texture, your skin is light. It's the fact that the laws and the culture tell you this. You have a right to go where you want to go, do what you want to do, be however, and people just gotta accommodate themselves to you. So here comes this word that, you know, you feel like you invented. And that's why I will tell you how to use a word that you invented. You know, well, why can't I use it? Everyone else gets to use it. You know what, that's racism that I don't get to use it. You know, that's racism against me. You know, I have to inconvenience myself and hear this song and I can't sing along? How come I can't sing along? You know what I mean? And I think, you know, for white people, I think the experience of being a hip-hop fan and not being able to use the word nigga is actually very, very insightful. It will give you just a little peek into the world of what it means to be black. Because to be black is to walk through the world and watch people doing things that you cannot do, that you can't join in and do. You know, and so I think there's actually a lot to be learned from refrain.
Yeah, I guess.
Responses? What do you think of that? There was a lot of humming in the room as he was talking. Anything to vocalize? John?
In my school in Florida, it's just prevalent for Hispanics to use the N-word. And I've talked to colleagues that are Hispanic. They just can't quite understand that, why that is. And is it ingrained in the rap culture probably too?
Does it help? Does this help? Does this give you some narrative?
It does a little bit, yes. Mm-hmm.
I found this really insightful. I hadn't thought about it with that lens before, to think of it at the systemic level, and that the rule he's applying is one that we all apply already. And he's saying, why don't we apply that rule to black people? Why do I keep insisting? Well, yeah, but I'm a good person. I don't mean anything by it. I just want to sing along. I want to be your buddy. I want to just sing along with you. I want to do it. And one of the things we feel entitled to do, by the way, is ask questions. And then when we get a response or a response we didn't expect or somebody's offended by the question, then we're kind of offended at their offense. Like, well, I'm a good person and I asked you a reasonable question. You know, explain this part of reality to me. What's it like to be gay and black? I mean, you're my friend. Tell me. Like, oh, I'm so tired of telling you this. You know, why am I telling everybody this? Is it my job to teach you? It is not my job to teach you.
I just heard somebody, I'm not going to be able to...
It's all right. Yeah.
You know, instead of having to tell the story of braids and how long does it take and what do you do, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. I'm really tired of having mm-hmm.
right.
to be the black person who tells all the white people about black hair.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really good one.
Yep.
Well, I mean, that was really super interesting for me because mm-hmm. I certainly have heard conversations about you can't say the N-word if you're white, but mm-hmm. I hadn't thought about that reason why, mm-hmm. about it being a cultural thing. This is our word. We can use it with each other, and it's fine
mm-hmm.
to set in that context. Anyway, it just made a lot of sense to me, and I love that it's really about mm-hmm. restraint. And then when I have a cousin who's black, and he lives in Atlanta, and he's been, you know, just the things that typically happen to a young man,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he's been followed home, he's been pulled over
sure.
and questioned, like, and just gets his mom, my aunt who's white, on the phone. They can't see her, but he's just on the phone with his mom the whole through. And but when he said, we walk through the world, you have to walk, if you're black, you have to walk through the world constantly,
mm-hmm.
things you can't do. I guess I haven't really thought about the day, in exactly that day.
Mm-hmm. I took out of this just his picking up on the fact that I really want to. That I feel sort of entitled to have this curiosity, and it is not to be thwarted. My curiosity is to be sated. I'm entitled to this. And the importance of other people in our systems. One of my students this term, I got to know, he's from Central California, but he talks about riding in a car with a friend of his who was white, who got pulled over for doing something he was doing as a driver, like not using his signal or something. And when the police officer leaned in, he saw my African-American student in the passenger seat and asked for his ID. And the driver said, uh-uh. The driver said, you are out of line, that you have no reason to ask for his ID. He's done nothing. There is no reason you need to know anything about him. And the cop acknowledged it and backed off. It's like, oh, you're right. You know, he went on with the traffic stop, but it was like, that's what needs to happen. It's like stepping into the system in a way. It was another kind of entitlement, but exercising it in a different way. Like, I'm entitled to talk to this cop in this way because my student didn't feel like he could talk to a cop in that way
right.
and be safe. That is not a
right.
safe thing to say
right.
in that situation. What you say is yes. So the other one that we often get asked about is this sense of, what about reverse racism? And it's usually asked with exactly that tone of voice, right?
Yeah.
What about reverse racism? So for this one, I actually want to go to a comic, because I think he explains it really well, and I want you to enjoy this. So I'd like to find this here on the little screen and play it for you. I will turn on the sound. If we can get this buzz to go away for my session tomorrow, we won't have to worry about this so much. He's not far wrong, is he?
Wow.
So, here's my last little bit for you. Thinking about sort of a charge for us. And it comes from many bases that we all honor. So here's one. Sometimes we just don't understand how to think about these words, but they're different. And I love this. Derricka Blackman works at Stanford University as their diversity officer. She's an African-American woman. But her coinage is, diversity is a fact. It's just how the world is. The world is diverse. Inclusion is a practice. It's something that people do. Also, exclusion is also a practice, right? But inclusion is not the same as diversity. Inclusion is a practice, something we do in the midst of diversity. And equity is a goal. Like, what are we trying for? Well, how about representation of people in the terms that they are present in the world? You know, that they should be present also in seats of power and making decisions that are consequential. So that's one kind of call, is just to distinguish the three. Recognize diversity. We can't do anything about that. The world's diverse. Inclusion is something we participate in interpersonally, organizationally, systemically, the whole thing. And equity is one goal of that. Here's a second basis from which to think about this. Richard Rohr, who I understand Reverend Mason also used this morning. I was interested to hear about this quote coming in here. Christianity is a lifestyle, a way of being in the world that is simple, nonviolent, shared, and loving. However, we made it into an established religion and all that goes with that and avoided the lifestyle change itself. One could be warlike, greedy, racist, selfish, and vain in most of Christian history, including right now, and still believe that Jesus is one's personal Lord and Savior. The world has no time for such silliness anymore. The suffering on earth is too great. So Richard Rohr, anybody know his background? I'd like to get it right.
Oh, he's a Franciscan monk.
Yeah.
And I believe that's correct.
I think that's right. And he's.
That's pretty much all I know. I mean, I read his stuff every day. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you do? He specializes in contemplation, I think. That's
yeah.
as much as I knew about him. Here's a third basis, and this comes from a grandmother at one of the protests that's erupted in the last 16 months or so, responding to people who'd rather not be political, which is a lot of the people I've gone to church with over the years, who just say, oh. And her response is, I want my friends to understand that doing so is privilege in action. My privilege allows me to live a non-political existence. My wealth, my race, my abilities, my gender lets me live a life in which I will not likely be targeted for bigotry, deportation, genocide. You don't want to get political, you don't want to fight, because your life and safety are not at stake. It's hard and exhausting to bring these things up, to get political. The fighting is tiring, I get it. Self-care is essential. But if you find politics annoying and you just want everyone to be nice, please know that people are literally fighting for their lives and safety. You might not see it, but that's what privilege does. For me, I was noticing my response to kids of families of color being separated at the American border when they apply for asylum, which is a legal activity, a legal activity. And I was thinking, how different would my response be if every one of the families being taken apart was coming from Austria or Iceland or Norway? Would I have even an iota of different response to it? It was worth asking. Do I feel any less investment in it because they are brown families, right, than white families? And if so, there's some whiteness coming into my sense-making again. Why am I not outraged at this? So I like this. This is a third bonus. And then here's the last one. This comes from the Talmud, which I really like. So in light of all those things, don't be daunted by the enormity of this particular grief. Do justly now, love mercy now, walk humbly now. You're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are we free to abandon it. That's a pretty interesting call, isn't it? So enjoy your conversations. We meet tomorrow 1.5 hour earlier in here because, again, we've got a 90-minute film and a little bit of discussion afterwards, but mostly the film. I think you really enjoy it. The film has a really good way of storytelling. It's divided up in chapters that are nice and neat, and I think you'll understand it, and it will provoke interesting discussion and questions for you. Friday, we'll talk about how to more actively be in conversation, respond to things that you see happening that you'd rather not have happening, and what you'd like to have going with that. So thanks for coming to this session. My pleasure.